A brain tumor diagnosis is a traumatic and life-changing event, resulting in altered priorities as part of a new normal way of life for a patient and their family. I'm Kathy Oliver, Chair and Co-Director of the International Brain Tumor Alliance. Since 2005, we've been creating a dynamic global community for brain tumor patient advocacy organizations and others involved in the field of neuro-oncology. Through our worldwide experience and expertise, we've been working to improve the well-being and quality of life for patients and their families. We advocate for the best treatments, information, and support for brain tumor patients, offering them, their families, and caregivers hope wherever they live in the world. In this series, we'll be meeting some of those working in the field of neuro-oncology, the people who support patients and their families, and those who've been told they have a brain tumor. We'll learn how brain tumors have affected all of these people, often in surprising ways. Welcome to A Brain Tumor and Me, a journey of inspiration, personal stories, and hope. Being told she had a very rare type of brain tumor at the age of just 27 is something Miranda Shipman from North Carolina in the United States certainly wasn't expecting. But it was an event that reshaped her life in so many ways. In this episode, Miranda talks to our reporter Graham Seaman about how she coped with the news of her first diagnosis and the surgery that saved her life, what happened when she discovered the tumor had later returned, and how she now faces the future.
Miranda, it's really lovely to meet you and to hear your story. Being told that you have a brain tumor is the start of a very personal journey. So can we start with you telling us about how you found out about your diagnosis?
So I had actually been sick for almost a year. The very first symptom that I had was biting into a piece of food at work, and the whole left side of my face went numb. And even in my ear canal, down in my throat, it was so strange. And so I thought at first, oh, I'm allergic to something. And then I talked to the person who had made the food and she told me what was in it. And it's stuff that I eat, you know, regularly. And so I went to my boss's office and I was like, I think I'm having a medical emergency, but I'm not sure what's happening. And so we called my doctor together and had her on speakerphone. And they said, well, if you can drive, then we think you'll be okay. If you're standing up and talking and can drive here, go ahead and do it. It's probably something like Bell's palsy. So I'm thinking, okay, I have Bell's palsy, maybe. And so I went to the doctor and they thought that's what it was, but it would go away and then it would come back every time I would eat. Then I started developing headaches and they were so bad, just so painful. And they would turn into migraines and I was missing work all the time and just so sick. And I would go to the doctor probably once a week for, it was 10 months. And one day I was talking to my boss. And so at the time I worked for a company that managed doctor's offices. And he said, you know, I know that you're sick, but you're missing a lot of work. You need to figure this out. And I was like, you know, I'm trying. But he suggested that I go to one of the doctors that we managed at my company, and they were a headache clinic. And so I went there and I spent 2 hours with a physician there. And she asked me a couple of key things. And one was, can you hear your heartbeat? And I said, yeah, I can hear it. Isn't that normal? And she said, people can feel their heartbeat, but you're not supposed to hear it. And that means that you probably have some sort of blockage or growth or something in the way. Maybe it's growing and blocking a blood vessel. We need you to have an MRI and an MRA as soon as possible. So I went ahead and had that done and then got the diagnosis that I had a brain tumor.
When you were told that you had this, what was the first thing that you felt?
Relief, just that we had figured it out. I remember during that 10 months of trying to figure out what was wrong, people would just brush it off because you look fine. And so when you look fine and you're young and people just don't believe you that something's wrong. I mean, I know my family did. I had a doctor even suggesting that I had made something up and how to deal with yourself when you think that you're sick and you're really not. So it was just a relief to know that I wasn't going crazy.
So tell us more about the tumor itself and how rare it is.
The tumor is an epidermoid brain tumor. And so epidermoids can actually grow anywhere on your body. They can just be little growths that, you know, you might go to a doctor and they lance off. But as far as brain tumors, they're extremely rare. Not a lot of surgeons do surgery on them. So you have to find the right one. But a really high percentage of them grow in this area of your brain called the cerebellopontine angle. And so it's right above your brainstem where your cerebellum and your pons meet. And it's a really dangerous area to have a brain tumor because that area controls your most basic primal functions like breathing, swallowing. And actually, that's the reason that when I would bite into food and my face would go numb, it was because I was using those muscles to chew and swallow, and it was somehow hitting up against the tumor and causing it to go numb.
You've got to have treatment, and you must have had the discussion about the future and the outcome of all this. So What was that about? What happened there?
So I had a really good surgeon. He was the head of neurosurgery at the hospital that I went to, and he was great. And he told me, you know, your brain tumor is extremely large. At that time, I think it was the size of a plum or a small orange. So very, very big. A lot of epidermoids don't grow at all. You might find them on an MRI if you hit your head and just get an MRI and they just don't grow. But some people have them where they grow slowly and you need them removed. So mine was fairly large at this point. And they said, you know, we could just let you live your life. You don't have to do anything. Brain surgery is the only way to take care of this and to get it out. And so it was, at this point, it was so big, they weren't sure if they could get the whole thing. But yeah, so I mean, if brain surgery is my option or just letting it grow until I die, I decided to go for the brain surgery, no matter the risk.
And how did the surgery go?
It went really well. I was shocked when they told me that they removed the entire tumor. So they got the whole thing out. It was really trauma to have brain surgery. It took me a really, really long time to recover from that. At the time, I lived alone, maybe about 30 minutes from my family. I just moved in with them for 4 or 5 months, and they had to take care of me, and I was on a schedule for all of my medications, and I mean, they were up like clockwork every 4 hours giving me medicine and helping me walk and helping me relearn how to do some things. But after that, I recovered really well. There's a point where you feel like nothing's gonna get better, but then you just kind of cross over it. I ended up going back to work within 6 months, slowly going back into work.
And of course, this is going to be so hard for your parents to see their daughter going through something like this.
I think they were pretty upset by the entire process, but I'm really thankful that I have a good support system, have great parents. My mom was a nurse, so she was excellent at caregiving, and then my dad's really just the sweetest guy. So yeah, they were great.
I was interested to know as well, Miranda, because your friends and your colleagues, how do they react to something like this? Because people do find it quite difficult. They don't know what to say. They don't know what to do.
You know, at the time I was in a bit of trouble from missing work and stuff. And when they finally got the diagnosis, they were like, take as much time as you need to recover. You'll have a job when you come back. They visited me in the hospital. I was only there for about 3 days, but they came with all their, you know, gifts. They were so sweet. And then my friends, it was kind of a mixed bag. I had a really great support system from a lot of my friends. And then I had a lot of friends who didn't know what to say. And they didn't contact me until well after I recovered. I had someone who contacted me about 2 years after, just apologizing, saying, you know, it scared me so bad. I thought you were going to die. I didn't know what to say. Like, in hindsight, that's not the right way to deal with it. But I just, you know, I had no idea what to do, and I'm sorry. And you've got to kind of understand that people don't know what to say. And then a lot of people say, everything happens for a reason, or this is your journey. And I don't know what reason I could have for being that sick, but and going through it. But so that bothered me at the time. I'm fine with it now.
Dealing with a diagnosis like this also means how you are going to handle it. Some take a hopeful and positive approach, others really find it to be a bit of a struggle. So did you make a conscious decision to have a certain attitude towards the situation you were now in and how you were going to deal with it?
Yeah, I did actually. That's a great way to put it, because I, other than the relief that I felt when I got diagnosed, I instantly went towards that darker path and of having no hope and just being pretty upset about it. And I remember eating dinner with a girlfriend before my surgery, and she pretty much told me to snap out of it. And I'm glad she did. She was just like, you know, your attitude's going to really dictate a lot during this, and you need to have the mindset that you're going to fight, that you're going to beat this, that you're going to get back to work afterwards, you're going to have a long life. And yeah, I'm glad she said it, because I was definitely moping around and thought, like, I can't believe this is happening to me. I'm so young. I'm relatively healthy. Yeah. So I chose the more hopeful path after that conversation. It was a nice wake up call.
Looking at the situation now, Miranda, how would you say this has changed you?
I mean, it's definitely changed my priorities in life, especially in the beginning. I couldn't handle people having issues that were very, you know, basic issues that they were talking about. I like had to step away from that as far as like, you know, my friends that would be upset about something that was wrong when they ordered dinner, because I knew that there are problems that are much bigger than that. It makes you want to focus on being a better family member and a better friend. Yeah, you get to see the big picture of, you know, my life could end whenever. And so you better make your time here count. So, I mean, I did a career change too.
So what did you decide to go and do?
So originally I had gone to school for art. I have a degree in painting and drawing and ran an art gallery and taught art, and I still paint, but I went back to school for neuroscience. And so now I work at Duke Hospital and I do research for another rare disease. It's not brain tumor research, and we're trying to create a drug for this rare disease. So that's what I do now.
Yeah, this is to do with dystonia, isn't it? So tell us a little bit more about that.
Dystonia is a rare movement disorder. It is the third most common movement disorder after benign tremor and Parkinson's, but it's still very rare. And the kind that I study is called DIT1 dystonia. And so it makes your body have spastic movements, but contort, and it's extremely painful. There's no cure. The only treatment right now is really Botox. Some people get deep brain stimulation, but not necessarily for DIT1 dystonia. DIT1 dystonia generally is diagnosed for kids around the age of 5, sometimes postmenopausal women.
What does it mean to you to be able to do that kind of work?
It's nice to be working with people who care about treating patients and also who care about the science behind it. But yeah, to know that I could potentially make a difference in someone's life, or at least take the science a step further so somebody else after me could make that difference, is great.
You mentioned Duke just a couple of minutes ago. This is a center that is pretty much a world leader.
Yeah, so Duke is a hospital in North Carolina. It's one of the best hospitals in the country, and they actually have a great neurosurgery center. I work in the research center behind it. It's also a university. So there's a university side and a hospital side, and I actually work for the hospital side. Are fortunate enough to have students come through our lab and do research too, and they're the cream of the crop. They're great.
You mentioned art. This played a very big part in your life. You said you had a career change and everything, but how much do you think your love of art has helped you through the journey that you've been on?
Well, in the beginning, it truly helped me in my recovery. After my first brain surgery, I was writing thank you letters. I remember being on the couch trying to write them, and I would think of something to say, write it down, and then I would read the card to myself before I put it in an envelope. And I realized that the words that I was thinking, they weren't actually the words that I had written down. And so I knew there's some sort of disconnect in my head. I was just trying to make sense of what was happening with my hands and what I was thinking with my head. So I started doing little paintings with watercolor. And I think doing that helped strengthen my connection to my brain and be able to put the right words down on paper later, the words that I was thinking. That really did help.
Are there any similarities between art and science?
Yeah.
If so, if you've got any examples of where those two have some kind of synergy?
Yeah, they definitely do. I think a lot of people think that, wow, you know, your career change was so drastically different. And I mean, going to school for art was really, really hard. And going to school for neuroscience was also really, really hard. They were just hard in a different way. But the similarities are that with art, you were obviously being very creative. But with science, I mean, even developing new drugs and thinking of where things might be malfunctioning in your body, you have to be creative with that. If you're not, then you're not going to push the bar forward with anything. So yeah, you definitely have to be creative. I do more photorealistic paintings, so it's very meticulous. And with science, you also have to be very meticulous. Yeah, it's helped with me. I do some surgeries in my lab and dissections, and the fine motor skills that you have for art also translate really, really well to a lab.
So tell us just a little bit more about this passion that you have for neuroscience.
Yeah, just studying the brain in general was very interesting for me. When I had first come out of the surgery and before I had made the switch, I tried volunteering with a lot of groups for brain tumor, like races and fundraising, and I loved it. So then learning about the brain when I decided to go back to school is just so interesting. And there's a lot that we know and there's a lot that we still don't know. It's challenging. And so I think it's nice to be in a field where you are challenged. I appreciate that. I like that.
Miranda, when you reflect on where you are now and where you were, the difference between the two, do you think this has made you stronger?
I wish it didn't take something like this to make me stronger, but I do think that it has made me a stronger person. I think it's made me a better person for sure.
How do you like to use your experience to help other people?
So what I've found is I actually got diagnosed with a second brain tumor. It was about 7 years after the first one. And so I had this panic moment. I went online. I searched just for any kind of support groups. And I found this group called the Epidermoid Brain Tumor Society. And I joined on Facebook. They had a Facebook page. And I found this group of people who were just like me. They had all the same symptoms, obviously. They had the same tumor. They had a lot of shared experiences with me where they had gone through surgery previously. A lot of people have surgery and then they're good forever, but there are some of us who have recurring tumors. Yeah, it was extremely cathartic to find that group. And to just find people that were just like me. And so I got really involved. I ended up becoming one of the directors and I work on their research committee. And so try to answer questions for people who maybe don't have a support system or don't know which hospitals are good and have the surgeons who would do the best job. And people who may not know if some symptom is something they need to go to the ER for or if it's something that's totally normal. So we kind of help answer questions with that. And then the research committee is always looking for researchers to study the epidermoid brain tumor and maybe figure out some sort of treatment that's not just surgery. I know sometimes they're doing radiation now. It's a new option, but it's not studied.
You talk about a recurring tumor. So where does that leave you now for the future? And that must have been quite something to have gone through all the surgery, had that experience, and then here you are in the same situation again.
Yeah, I definitely had felt a sense of relief with the first one, knowing like I'm not crazy, I can get this out, I'll feel better. But the second one, I didn't feel bad. They found it on a scan, like a you have to have scans every year. And so they just found it on that. And then we started to watch it. And after about 2 years, it had grown enough to need to be removed. So I had to have a second brain surgery, and it crushed me. I definitely had a lot of anxiety and was just super, super sad about it. That's also, again, where you kind of have to choose hope and choose to focus on things that you can control, because this is completely out of my control. My control would be advocating for myself with my health and finding a group of people like the Epidermoid Brain Tumor Society that understand me and to talk to them. But yeah, the future is very, I don't want to say uncertain, but it definitely feels a little bit more scary than your average 38-year-old.
Talking of the positive sides of things, though, what would you say has been probably the most enlightening or positive thing to come out of all this for you?
There are so many positives that have come out. I know I talked about how scary it was and the anxiety, but I mean, the career change was very positive. I loved my career in art, but I really do love doing research. I love the community that I have with the Epidermoid group. I definitely think I have better friendships now and better relationships, just in general. And yeah, it's a really positive thing, and definitely knowing that I shouldn't squander my life. So it's positive. It's been a positive experience, even though it's been a very scary experience.
Is there anything in particular that you've discovered about yourself that you didn't know was within you until this happened?
Honestly, I mean, if you had told me when I was in my early 20s that I would be doing research at a wonderful research center and hospital, I would have laughed in your face. I would have never thought that I could do something like that, or even go back to school as an adult. It's just, yeah, I would have never, ever envisioned that happening, but it did, and I did it, and I did well, so.
What about spare time activities? What kind of things do you get up to? I mean, I'm guessing some kind of realistic art might be in there, but are there other things as well that you really enjoy doing?
Yeah, I mean, I love painting, but I found that I really love pottery, and that's been a really fun hobby to have. It's definitely letting go of the perfectionist side of me, because it's really hard. So that's been really fun. We have a camper, so I like to go camping and canoeing and hiking, and we have a dog, so we take him with us everywhere. But traveling's been very fun. That's pretty much my hobby.
Miranda, for anyone listening right now who's been told that they too have a brain tumor, what message would you send to them?
The message that you can get through it, you can live a happy life, and if it's terminal, you can still choose to make the most of your time. And I would say, as far as treatment goes, you need to advocate for yourself, find a group of people. There are tons of groups online with people that maybe even live around you. One of my neighbors is in my group, and she's been living with an epidermoid for a long time. And and advocate for yourself with your doctors. Get a second opinion, hands down, because your doctor may have only done one surgery or treated one person with your type of tumor. And there may be another doctor out there who's a little bit better. Even if you like your doctor, it's not going to hurt their feelings. If you say you're getting a second opinion, they should expect it. But you and your family can advocate for yourself, and that is huge.
And finally, Miranda, this series, as you know, is all about hope. How would you describe that? And what are your hopes for the future of neuroscience research, for example, and your own type of brain tumor?
You can choose to be hopeful about the situation and that things will get better. And like I said before, to try to focus on things that you do have control over, and know that there are some things, like a brain tumor, that you will never, ever have control over. And yeah, as far as neuroscience research, I truly hope that there is more research for different types of brain tumors, and that there's more funding. Even if a lab has funding to do the research, they might not have the funding to actually pay top-notch employees. And so that would be great if we could do that. And yeah, the hope is that nobody has to die with one ever in the future. As far as myself, I think the hope is to live a long and happy life, not wasted, be a good friend, be a good family member.
That was Miranda Shipman from North Carolina in the United States, talking to our reporter, Graham Seaman. In our next episode of the series...
When she was 4 years old, we noticed some things happening that weren't normal. She understood she had a brain tumor. She understood that there was treatment that she needed to have. We've had hundreds of school hugs across different parts of our country that have united children in helping them be who they want to be.
That's Denise Bebenek from Toronto in Canada, who lost her 5-year-old daughter, Megan, to an inoperable brain tumor. Just how does a mother come to terms with losing a child in such a tragic way? Denise talks about the effect it had on her and her family, the power of community, and how it inspired her to start Megan's Hug 20 years ago, which creates awareness of pediatric brain tumor research, supports families, and raises vital funds. I'm Kathy Oliver, Chair and Co-Director of the International Brain Tumor Alliance, and you've been listening to A Brain Tumor and Me, a journey of inspiration, personal stories, and hope. If you'd like to find out more about the work we do, just go to our website, theibta.org. And thank you for listening. This has been a Graham Seaman Media production for the IBTA.